UCLA professor Robin D.G. Kelly is a historian, civil rights activist, and a bit of a jazz scholar. I'm Philip Bailey, and this is Noise and Notes. Kelly was in Louisville this week to discuss what he believes is a war on youth and the persistent worship of the free market in American politics. Professor Kelly stopped by to talk about President Obama's re-election, the problem with capitalism, and the art and life of Thelonious Monk.
History, I think, is always the entry point to figure out what's going on. And when we think of our current political problems or economic problems, I think about it as economic problems as well, we have to have a long view. So many of the issues that we're dealing with now, whether you're talking about, the debt and deficit, you're talking about, global trade, you're talking about, the U.S. involvement in all these wars, covert and overt wars. So much of that stuff goes back to not just like the Reagan administration, but back in the 70s, the collapse of the welfare state and the rise of the warfare state. And what I'm going to talk about tonight is the development of neoliberal ideology. And that is this idea that you can privatize and free market yourself out of the problems at hand. And of course, the effect of that is massive income inequality and the erosion of the public sphere, whether you're talking about public education, welfare state, and the expansion of the punitive state. I mean, that's sort of where we are, and that's affecting all realms of, I think, political discourse.
It seems that the political coverage from the media and also the way we talk to politicians negates history, because a large part of criticism of President Obama and this campaign was that you're still blaming George W. Bush. Yeah. But from your perspective, we should go back even further than that, all the way into maybe even Eisenhower's administration to see the roots of some of these problems. That just, there seems to be a disconnect between how we talk about our politics 4 years from now, right, 4 years ago, and the actual roots of some of these problems.
Exactly. We're locked into these four-year cycles, and they don't really make sense with how history operates. I mean, even if you think about the future, like the improvement in the economy, the recovery from the recession, well, some of these things are going to happen, irregardless of who's in power. I mean, we're going to have job growth. We're going to have all that stuff. But to me, the real issue isn't just the four-year cycle, but the way that not just the media, but politicians themselves use the four-year cycle to their advantage or disadvantage. I mean, you think about how the Romney campaign, for that matter, all the Republican candidates, revised history in such a way to put even the war in Afghanistan on Obama's watch, to put the economic crisis on Obama's watch, and to really manipulate statistics and that sort of thing to change the story. And the problem is, as an electorate, as a citizenry, we're not equipped. We've lost the kind of critical faculties to be able to make decisions without having to rely on media.
Because a large part of it is selling you the candidate, not even the ideas, the slogan, forward, change,
absolutely,
country first. But in your mind, because you're someone who's critical of both Republicans and,
yes,
Democrats, I mean, neoliberalism is a critique of the Democratic Party in a lot of ways, particularly,
absolutely,
during the Clinton era. Did the outcome of the 2012 election matter, in your view, at all?
It did matter. And I don't want to give the impression, because I'm very critical of the Obama administration on very specific things. But what mattered to me were at least three things. One was the future of the Supreme Court. I mean, that really does matter, because I think whoever's president could really shape the future of justice in this country. Whether it's reproductive rights, civil rights, that sort of thing. Two, it mattered in terms of a potentially energy policy and at least thinking about climate change and green energy, which is something that wasn't even on Romney's radar. But on the other hand, Obama hasn't done a great job either in terms of trying to move us forward. And there's other pressures there. But then I think the third thing just has to do with even if it's rhetorical, this idea that you build a society on the strength of the working class and middle class. And that's Obama's rhetorical stance. I think it's a very good one. It's one that I would support, as opposed to this idea that the quote-unquote job creators, if you give them more tax cuts, if they become wealthier, it's a repeat, not of the Bush policies per se, it's that too, but it's Reagan policies, the trickle-down theory, except it's a more extreme version of that. So I think we would have had some substantial differences, but that doesn't mean, that doesn't take the Obama administration off the hook, nor does it take Clinton off the hook or any of them, because the one thing that they all have in common is this general principle that the free market ultimately is the best course forward. The only difference is that there's free market with some regulation and free market with no regulation. Free market with some social safety net, free market with no social safety net. And I'm saying we need to really rethink that altogether.
From the left's perspective, what are some issues in which the Obama administration has completely failed? I think of drone attacks. People have really been critical of that. The use of drones, both domestically and abroad, not having a public option in the healthcare laws, another thing that comes to mind. What are some other things that progressives are upset with, the far left, upset with about this president? And on a scale, how liberal is President Obama?
Well, on the first question, you named two of some of the really essential issues. The drone strikes are very, very important because so many civilians are dying as a consequence of those. And I think that Obama's foreign policy leaves much to be desired, especially around Israel.
Because he gets praised for that. That's the one thing people say, oh, the president, he's strong on foreign policy.
Well, you know, he's strong on a kind of neo-empire foreign policy, because basically it's, you know, it's the U.S. empire policies of the Bush administration, but with a kinder and gentler face and one that doesn't believe in unilateralism, but multilateralism. I mean, that's the only difference. I think the current policies with regard to Israel and the Palestinians, I think, are disastrous. And I think it's a left critique coming from that vantage point. Now, let's talk about domestic policy, because foreign policy is easy. Domestic policy is a little more difficult, because I think the left has been critical of a few things. One, he caved on the Keystone Pipeline. Two, I think the auto bailout, which has had tremendous cachet for the president and actually has gained significant labor support. And I don't want to take anything away from it, but there's some elements of the auto bailout that are not talked about, like the fact that it was a huge give back on the part of labor. I mean, 40% of the auto workers, you know, basically came in making 50% less. You know, took a 50% wage cut. Huge. And I can imagine, you know, here in Kentucky, where you, as you were suggesting earlier, that there's, you know, a significant, you know, auto industry here.
Because we have a lot of conversations about jobs, but not about wages.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, wages are not even in the orbit.
Yeah, when it comes to unemployment, anytime that there's a job opening, we never talk about, well, is the earning power of the middle class. I mean, that was one of the more daunting statistics of this recession, the fact that how much people have lost in wealth, particularly along lines of race. But on a scale, though, how liberal is the president? Because we hear from the right, oh, he's a socialist, which isn't true.
No. But no, I would categorize Obama as a neoliberal president, very much in line with Bill Clinton. He may be slightly more liberal than Bill Clinton on some issues, but it's the same mold. And that mold is one where you think about Clinton's policies. They were very strong in terms of anti-immigration. And despite Obama's support for the DREAM Act, this is a president that deported more
been deported onto him than President Bush.
Exactly. And he's proud of that. He's proud of that. Because for him, the way he framed it, it's sort of about law and order, like Clinton. I think Clinton certainly pushed for greater deregulation, But then again, Obama might be, you know, the regulation president in some regards, but he's also the president who, with his attorney general, refused to prosecute, you know, Wall Street criminals, in a sense. You know, much of what happened that led to the financial meltdown in 2008 actually is prosecutable. I mean, you could prosecute on a number of different laws, RICO laws and this sort of thing, but it never happened. And I think that as much as Wall Street is, you know, pushing back against Obama, they should be patting him on the back because they got off scot-free in some ways, you know. So he's someone who really does believe in the system. He believes in the Constitution, and that's great. He believes in the free market. He just believes in a free market in which, you know, any kind of crisis could be taken care of by the state.
You are here in Louisville as the keynote speaker at the annual Ann Braden Memorial Lecture, and your lecture is entitled The War on Youth. Everything in this country, I'm assuming, now needs a war for people to care about it. drugs, crime, poverty, et cetera, in order for it to be relevant in our vocabulary. But what do you mean by that, the war on youth?
Yeah, I'm specifically speaking of a number of things. You know, the fact that young people have the highest unemployment rates, particularly young people of color.
I think for African Americans, it's 21%. Hispanics,
it's, well, for young,
13,
for young,
18 to 29.
Right, exactly. Yeah. For young African Americans in cities, it's 40%.
Yeah.
You know, it's huge.
That's the Depression era.
Right, exactly. And so, I say the war on our youth, you know, in the title, and it's by our youth, I'm also raising questions about who our youth are, because I talk about the dreamers and the 67%ers who are basically saying that, you know, we as Latinos, as undocumented youth, if we're not in college, we're not going to benefit from the Dream Act, for example. I talk about the continuing police violence directed at African Americans, you know, and vigilante violence in the way of Trayvon Martin. But much of what I talk about has to do with policing in schools themselves. That is the consequence of zero tolerance policies. In Los Angeles, you know, they have the LA school police and curfew laws that were implemented in 1995 that really led to kind of a crackdown on truancy, on, you know, lateness, and it's been a huge burden on young people.
Some of the same problems we're facing here in Louisville, where Jefferson County Public Schools has a zero tolerance policy, and I believe Ann Marshall of Leo Weekly, which is the alt weekly here in the city, did a story on how that disproportionately affects poor and minority youth.
Right, right, exactly. It's a national problem, and I don't know as much about Louisville, but I know that all over the country, these zero tolerance policies have actually done more to keep kids from coming to school, and, you know, tie that to massive disinvestment in public education, the privatizing of public education. It's been very difficult for this generation and the next generation to make it, especially when the state has become much more punitive than before. Now, that's not this. Now, again, I don't want to give the impression I'm like letting young people off the hook and, you know, that they're not significant social problems and social ills that people have to struggle with. But the punitive nature of, you know, the state right now has made it much more difficult for young people to really succeed and really, you know, get a decent education and new possibilities.
I read somewhere years ago when I was still in college that you were an avowed communist. Are you still one?
No, I'm not a communist, but I was, and I'm not ashamed to say that.
This isn't the Red Scare.
Oh yeah, no.
We're not going to lie. Ask you to give us a list about your friends and family.
Right. No. I'm. Do I lean toward Marxism? I think Marxism is useful sometimes. Sometimes it's not. Depends on what we're looking at. I like to think of myself more as a dialectical thinker, and that is, you know, I'm very Catholic when it comes to various ideologies. The thing that I really do, I'm consistent about, is the importance of justice, you know, in defining what justice is important. But
you certainly benefit from the free market, though. Are there any redeeming qualities of that?
Well, you know, part of it, it's not so much that it's not so much being for or against free market, it's free market ideology. Because the truth of the matter is that we don't really have a free market. Because if we had a free market, then there would be no bailout. You know, there wouldn't have been a bailout.
Yeah, it's a mix of capitalism and socialism sort of control. I mean, government does step in when it feels that this industry will totally throw the country into a loop.
Yeah, and I would say capitalism, but state-supported capitalism, meaning that I wouldn't call it socialism. What I would call it is a very interventionist government to support capital, but often at the expense of poor and working people. You know, I'll give you a very clear example. I mean, the bailout was an example of what happens when you use public funds to solve a problem of private risk, right? So these bankers and investment bankers and Wall Street tycoons basically risk other people's money to make money. When
we see that even at the local level, whether basketball arenas like the one here in Louisville or entertainment district like 4th Street Live. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's how the system's set up. It's set up so that, I mean, even the idea of whether it's legislation or whether it's state bonds or city bonds to pay for these things, the public pays for them for someone else's wealth. And so what I'm saying is that we don't really have a free market. The free market is a myth. Free market ideology suggests that a kind of casino capitalism. That is, you can gamble all you want because you know the state's going to be there to bail you out. You know, if we really believed in free market, I mean, free market in terms of Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, free market in terms of 19th century liberalism, then there'd be a lot of businesses collapsing right now, you know. What I like to think of is I believe in a kind of labor-based justice, that labor is important, that wages are important, that what we need is a society in which people who work for a living can benefit from the fruits of their labor. You know, that's not to say that everyone's going to be equal and everyone's going to have the same thing, but it's to say that labor produces the wealth, you know, and I still do believe that. And so there's no reason why someone who gambles money with the protection of the state should be able to be like a multi-billionaire, whereas people who actually produce the wealth for that person to gamble, living as paupers and could easily lose their home or job at someone else's whim.
What are your thoughts then on the Occupy Wall Street movement that sprouted up all across the country? There was one here even in Louisville. Some degrees of success were measured. Many said that was the left's equivalent of the Tea Party movement. We didn't see any Occupy Wall Street candidates running for Congress this year, maybe 2 years from now. I think maybe, generally speaking, the left eschews electoral politics more than the right does.
Right.
But what were your thoughts on Occupy Wall Street, good or bad?
Well, Occupy specifically decided not to run candidates. In fact, I should say Occupy split. There's about three or four different splits. And there was one side of the Occupy movement that actually decided to try to run candidates at some point and participate in electoral politics. I was very critical of some aspects of Occupy, but also very excited about other aspects. And that's how it always is. I mean, one thing I was very critical of was that in their statement of principles, you know, in New York City, there was a kind of tendency to, you know, collapse everything under the 99% and not really pay attention to sort of divisions of race.
Was that more of a slogan, though? Because I get what you're saying. When you looked at the scale, the Wall Street Journal put out actually a calculator to show who's in the 99%, mm-hmm. who's actually in the 1%. And when you get into the 99%, you're talking about someone who might live in Mississippi who's making $5,000 annually on public assistance and someone who's making $80,000 in Chicago living in Hyde Park.
Right. Like
they're considered the 99%. I think there's even a big gap between those individuals.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And then you talk about issues of race.
Yeah. No. And I think the issue of race is a real and an analytical issue. That is that the slogan of the 99%, which is a very powerful one, is to say we're all in this together. Problem is that we're not all in it in the same way. And there's some people within the 99% who benefit from the oppression of other people. And so part of what happens is if you say we're all 99%, then we have to deal with our class issues and ignore the race issues, deal with the class issues and ignore the gender issues. You know, and I think part of some of the best elements of the Occupy movement actually didn't do that. They were very attentive to issues of racism and mass incarceration, all these different issues. The other thing about the Occupy movement, which I think is worth considering, is that in their statement of the basic statement of principles, there was a tendency on the part of some of the sort of mainstream elements to say, you know, we're not against corporations per se. We're against bad corporations or bad corporate policy or greed. And if you reduce the problem to greed, then the structural elements that got us into this mess in the first place are not attended to, not really looked at carefully. And then, so that's part of my critique. At the same time, Occupy was part of a global revolutionary moment. It's tied to the Arab Spring. Arab Spring had a lot to do with inspiring Occupy. It's tied to what happened in Wisconsin, where, you know, teaching assistants started this, you know, where unions came out and really pushed to defend the rights of labor. And I think that if we think of the Occupy movement as one of many, many prongs, the year 2011 was maybe the most exciting moment of possible global revolution, you know, and it seemed so long ago.
Yeah, right. I know. Besides being a historian and a political commentator, you're also considered a jazz scholar. You wrote a biography on Thelonious Monk. First, how do you research for something like that? And do you find that maybe as a public intellectual, interesting that people know maybe less about your academic work, like Hammer and Hoe, mm-hmm. your dissertation, mm-hmm. But they know more about your popular pieces like your Thelonious Monk biography or one of my favorite books of yours, Your Mama's Dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's a great question. I mean, I do have people who don't know all sides. And I've, you know, Thelonious Monk is my bestseller, by the way. Just, you know, my ex-wife's very happy about that. but that book has done very, very well. And and it's a labor of love for me. It's the book that I feel closest to. And yet none of my own political training or questions, all that's actually in the book. You know, it's trying to understand, for example, Monk's life as an artist, but also following the money, for example. Figuring out like, what his contract consisted of? How much money did he make for a living? How did the industry actually work? And to me, some of that stuff is very, very exciting. It's very interesting because you follow what I was able to do is follow this musician and understand how is it that someone of such genius, of such imagination, such boldness, barely made a living, even at the height of his powers, you know? And so in some ways, I feel like my work kind of comes together. But the jazz, like the really, really extreme jazz fans, they just want to know about Monk. You know, the context is not that important for them. But I really enjoyed working on Monk.
And a friend asked me this. Why do people, and I'm not sure if this is an urban myth or not, why do people believe that Monk didn't have to practice the piano?
Because his sound was, as the critics would call it, like, gave the impression it was childlike, that it was something very simple about his dissonance, about his phrasing. And actually, it's not true at all. In fact, what I discovered, because I found, you know, we found like homemade tapes of him rehearsing, things like that. And it was much harder for Monk to sound like Monk than it was for him to sound like a pianist like Teddy Wilson or Art Tatum, who were considered, you know, artists with all this facility. Now, why is that? Well, Monk, you know, heard certain things, heard certain sort of sonorities by listening sometimes to classical music, listening to those late 19th century Impressionist composers. And he's classically trained. You know, that's another thing. You know, he could play Rachmaninoff, he could play all that stuff. But, you know, part of understanding Monk is understanding all the background noise that surrounded him. All the critics decided he was crazy, he was eccentric, he was like a small child in a man's body, And he was none of those things. But Monk sometimes played into that because he knew, he was a free market guy.
It sounds sort of like, in some ways, Tupac Shakur, playing the character people think you are.
Yes.
If you could, when someone writes a book on someone, this is America, mm-hmm. we only know popularity. We've been having a conversation between the intellectual and the popular. Who should play Thelonious Monk in a movie about his life?
Oh, boy. See, if I say this and it gets out, then people are going to be mad at me. I could tell you who approached me about playing Monk. It's a couple people. Wendell Pierce is one.
From Tremé and
from
The
Tremé,
Wire.
Yeah. Right. And one person really, really, well, Denzel Washington expressed an
interest. Of course.
He never approached me directly about it, but he expressed an interest.
I thought Forrest Whitaker.
Forrest Whitaker.
He played
Bird.
Bird.
Right. And
Idris Elba.
Yeah,
the ladies love Idris.
Definitely.
He'll come out.
Idris Elba approached me directly about, before the book was out. His people got in touch and said, he really wants, and then HBO was interested.
Well, as long as you don't get Tyler Perry to play him, I'll be there.
Trust me, there'll be no Tyler Perry.
Robin D.G. Kelly, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.